point is like each individual takeover can have nuance to it, but you better make sure everyone who's involved in that understands the unified narrative.
Welcome to the Multifamily Wealth Podcast. I'm your host, Axel Ragnarsson, and on this show, I dissect how seasoned multifamily investors started, built, and scaled their businesses. What's going on, everybody? Welcome back to another episode here on the Multifamily Wealth Podcast. I have a great episode this week with Jared Sturm of SNS Capital Group. Jared is an extremely accomplished investor based in Cincinnati. He's the owner and operator of over 1,300 units, and he has a very inspirational story. He started in the business as a maintenance tech back in his teenage years and has since built an incredible platform, a vertically integrated multifamily platform, construction in-house, management in-house, over 50 full-time employees. Him and his brother partnered back in the early 2010s to start buying foreclosure properties, single families, and he's just organically grown his business over the last 15, 16 years. In this episode, we dive into the tactical and operational side of the business as it relates to asset management, construction, operations, property management. So this is a really great episode for those of us out there who are on the front lines operating multifamily assets. Talk a lot about metrics that you should be tracking, KPIs that are important to understand, the systems and the processes from an asset management standpoint that really drive the success of a multifamily property from an NOI standpoint. So this is a real in the weeds episode. And I love recording these episodes because I think the active multifamily investors out there walk away with something that they can implement in their business. And the LPs walk away with something that they can go talk to a prospective GP about, ask these types of questions and look for these types of operators. Because these are the types of operators that you want to be investing with, are the people that have the infrastructure built out to do what Jared is doing and what we talk about in this episode. So really excited to release this one. If you enjoy it, please consider leaving the podcast a rating and a review. Coming up on 275 reviews, I believe, which is our next major milestone. Podcast is really getting up there as it relates to the number of reviews that we've generated. And it's in the top of the industry as it relates to being one of the most highly reviewed podcasts. And I want to keep pushing to climb that ladder. So if you've learned something at any point in time listening to the episodes on the pod, please consider leaving the show a rating and a review. But let's get to this week's episode with Jared Sturm. What's going on, everybody? Welcome back to another episode here on the Multifamily Wealth Podcast. Joining me this week is an incredibly accomplished multifamily investor, Jared Sturm out of Cincinnati, who has built a pretty similar business to the one that I'm in the process of building. And a lot of the listeners are aware of what we do at Aligned Real Estate Partners in terms of buying multifamily, owning and operating in-house, raising capital to do so. And Jared has built a very sizable business out in the Midwest, out in Cincinnati. But Jared, why don't we start with your background? You know, thanks again for coming on the show here, and would love to learn a little bit more about how you got into the real estate business and what your business looks like today.
Yeah, no, thank you. I really appreciate it. And Axel, I owe you a thank you, and anyone else who's involved in producing this podcast, certainly appreciate their times and their effort to give me the platform to share my story. So thanks so much. Happy to jump back to the beginning, which, crazy enough, is 18 years ago now. So I've been in the industry for 18 years, bought my first investment property 16 years ago. But prior, going all the way back 18 years, I was a maintenance tech. So I was the guy, you know, changing the toilets out, painting the apartments, hanging blinds, and doing renovations to another local landlord here in the Cincinnati, Ohio market. So I did that as I went through high school. Senior year, I did it full time because our school had a program where we could work full time. And that evolved into friends and family asking, can you fix this? Can you fix that? And then, you know, ultimately that resulted in, can you redo my bathroom? Can you redo my kitchen? And so myself and my brother, who's my business partner today, we started a construction company doing kitchens and bathrooms, putting additions on people's homes. And we just kind of learned that through the school of hard knocks, but always had a natural aptitude for it. And then in 2008, we kind of looked around and said, there's a lot of foreclosures out here. Why don't we start buying some of these and fixing them up? So we did that, and we're renting out single families, small multis on the nights and weekends when we weren't working on someone else's house. We would go in and renovate our own and then rent them out. And then fast forward to today in 2024, we have about 1,300 units here in Cincinnati, Ohio, 50 employees. And as you mentioned, I think you mentioned this while we were recording, vertically integrated. So all of our construction as well as property management's in-house. And that's what makes up most of those 50 employees.
Wow. That's a hell of a story. And there's one part of it that, I mean, we could dive into any components of it, but you know, if we're going from maintenance tech to construction company with your brother to fixing and renovating single family homes, you know, turn of 08 into the early 2010s, you jumped there from doing some of those projects up to, you know, we had 1300 units, we're vertically integrated, we have a big team.
Yeah.
Let's kind of dissect maybe the transition from doing single family homes. You mentioned you were renting them out and building a portfolio. I would imagine it was maybe kind of organic growth along the way, but describe that journey a little bit more as it relates to what occurred along the way that made you think multifamily or raising capital. You know, what was that journey like?
Yeah, it's a great question. And I know you said your audience is a lot of, you know, active investors who are looking to potentially take a similar path. And I guess I'll preface that by saying, you know, my way is not someone else's way. My way is definitely not the right way. It's just the way that ended up working out for us. But 2008 through, you know, 2015 was a very different market and different market conditions than what we're seeing today. First eight houses that we bought took us about 2 years to acquire. You know, we were 18 and 21 year old kids that didn't have W-2 jobs. So no lender, and this was at the depths of a financial recession. So no lender was lending to us. So the first eight houses were purchased all cash, renovated all cash, but also prices were very, very low. So we were able to do that. And then after 2 years with that portfolio of eight houses, we went to a local bank, got a portfolio cash out refinance, and then deployed that into buying more homes. So we made that wise decision. And we talk about like tipping points in our journey. That was one, right? So at 20 years old, I could have made the decision to spend that sizable check in not so responsible ways, but 100% of it went back into more properties and renovating more to then have this snowball effect that has put us in the position today. But to answer your question, Axel, first 8 years was buying single families and small multis with no investors. So, you know, we built up a sizable portfolio with no investors. And then in 2015, we bought a 42 unit apartment community again with no investors and really enjoyed the economies of scale, the ability to renovate with systems and processes. We said, we really like this, but we're out of money. So we needed another way of doing this. And so we went into the syndication model. And so first 8 years was with our own funds. Last 8 years of the 16-year period was doing the syndication model, raising money from outside investors.
Gotcha. No, that context is helpful. Yeah, it's funny. I mean, it's so similar to our story and our business, right? Where 5-6 years of really making your own dollar stretch. And then at some point you get a little stressed out about the fact that you got money spread over all kinds of different projects and you're taking the cash out proceeds from one to renovate the other one. And you realize there's probably a better way to do it or a way to do it that allows you to sleep a little bit better. And at least that was the realization that I came to. But, you know, so it sounds like organic growth along the way, right? We're gradually growing small multis. But a 42 unit is a sizable deal, right? And it sounds like from a time frame standpoint, and correct me if I'm wrong, this is like 2014, 2015, you kind of took this deal down if I'm following your timeline, and correct me again if I'm wrong. But let's talk about that deal a little bit, because that seems like the one that kind of made you jump, right? Was that a deal that was sourced through a broker? Was that an off-market deal? Was that like a really hairy kind of reposition that you guys felt comfortable with all of your construction experience? Like what really called you to that deal?
Yeah, I like that question. And I think my answer is probably not what you would expect. It was a pretty cookie cutter deal that was listed on market. Your timing is correct. So I believe it was the end of 2015. And so we knew we wanted to transition into apartment communities because we had experienced it in say like 10 unit deals and 5 unit deals, like the taste of efficiencies that you get relative to like single family homes, right? And so we wanted to make that jump. And so the year prior, we said, well, you know, this is going to be multi-million dollar transaction. We're not going to raise money from investors. How are we going to get those funds? And what we did was we used the skill set we had. So we went out and we flipped 17 houses, doing all the work ourselves. We weren't hiring out, you know, we weren't hiring out vendors. So the profit margins were significant because all of that was falling on us. Now we were willing to put in 80-100 hour weeks of working on them to generate the cash to then be able to buy this apartment community. But I mean, it was a property built in the late 90s. Every single unit is identical, all two bedroom, two baths, you know, brick exteriors, pretty cookie cutter deal that we said, this is going to be easy for us to renovate and operate for the long term. And so no heavy distress, was definitely on market and was a very wise decision to buy nonetheless.
Mm-hmm. No, that's great. I mean, and well, you answered the question, right? Because the follow-up was going to be for me. Well, you know, obviously there's, you're making money either flipping homes or successfully buying small multis, cash out refi, you're starting to grow the portfolio, there's free cash flow. And that's probably how you fund a deal of that size, right? Because it's a sizable deal. Even if we're talking lower price per units back in the mid 2010s, I mean, it's still relative to what you were doing at the time. And that's still large, but you answered it, right? Flipping 17 homes where you guys are doing the work is going to generate some cash without a doubt. Now, in terms of management and actually building out the operational infrastructure along the way, and that's kind of where I want to spend a segment of our conversation here, is you're vertically integrated. You manage all of your own buildings right now. And was that always the case? Like, have you always had it in-house under your umbrella? And then I'm going to have some follow-ups after that, but just want to confirm that that was the structure that you've used throughout the life cycle of growing the business.
It is. It's always been that way. But Axel, it's funny. When we were at like 20, maybe 25 units, we kind of said, we had an awareness at that time to say, either we need to hire a third-party management company, or we need to focus on building a business that is a management company that supports our assets. And so this is, you know, I don't know what year this is, but this was just only a few years into our journey. And ultimately, the decision we thought we wanted to make was hire a third-party management company so we could focus on the construction side of things and let them handle that. And our approach was a little bit different. Rather than go to the corporate office and the sales rep for the third-party property management company, what we did is we found similar assets to what we had in our portfolio. And we reached out to those listings as if we were prospective tenants, right? So I wanted to see how they were handling customer service, how are they handling things as simple as like fair housing law or responsiveness, right? And fortunately for us, the results were really bad. And so we never got comfortable with handing over what we see as the most important component of investment, rental real estate. And so we pivoted and said, well, we're not doing third-party management because it looks like all these third-party management companies don't know what they're doing. We're going to build this ourselves, vertically integrated. And then, you know, the rest is history as we built up this company.
Yeah. And that, you know, I think a lot of people probably find themselves in a similar situation where you hit an inflection point where you're starting to get spread a little too thin as it relates to finding deals, construction management, if you're raising capital, that part of the process as well, transaction mm-hmm. coordination, and then you got property management, right? At the end of it as well, in terms of, you know, once you close, obviously the work really starts and then committing the time there. Mm-hmm. In our business, we happen to go the third party route. We, you know, reached a similar point that you did, but just me being in the business, it wasn't really something that I felt comfortable allocating my time towards. And I really wanted to go all in on finding deals. And then later I came around once we hit 60, 70 units with third party. And I just wasn't really happy with the level of service to where then we brought it in-house when there was a little bit more scale. Not that that's considerable scale at all. And there's all kinds of challenges with doing that. But that was the roadmap that I took, which, you know, leads me to the question for you of, so early on, you're at 20 units and change here and you want to bring it in-house. You realize that you want to control this part of the process. Did you and your, you know, assuming that you and your brother are still working here at this point, like, did you kind of define roles and say that, you know, I'm responsible for this, you're responsible for that? Was there a hire made, somebody to bring into the business to kind of help own and, or, you know, I guess manage that component of the business? Or how did you start allocating your time once you decided that was how you wanted to go?
Yeah, Axel, I'm sure you remember, you know, when you're at that size, you wear a lot of hats and those hats yeah. get yanked on and off pretty frequently. And so that's what was happening between me and my brother. You know, we work really, really well together. And so we were able to juggle that without very clear lines, which it's too hard to have clear lines at that size, being like, you know, a couple hundred units even. It's you're doing too many things to have very clear lines. You know, fast forward to today, my technical title is CEO, my brother's is COO, and then we have a third partner now, his title is CFO. Still, even today, the lines are a little bit blurred. They're more defined now than they were then. But the way we got from zero employees to 50 employees is our approach was always do as much as we could until we hit absolute maximum and then hire that position out. I don't know if that's the right way, but that was certainly what we did. And so, you know, early hires is going to be like a leasing agent, right? I was tired of changing out of my maintenance clothes into dress clothes to try to lease the apartment and then go back and do maintenance. And so ultimately we made a hire, and the whole time during this process, we're thinking, how do we build systems and processes, and how do we make this cleaner, and how do we create expectations for our employees? And made a ton of mistakes along the way and have learned a lot. But I truly, in my very biased opinion, but a lot of people would agree with this, in Cincinnati, you know, we are the best operators of multifamily assets now. So we've learned through the School of Hard Knocks a lot of lessons that have made us a very good property management company. And we only manage what we own because we care a lot about it. So we want to see it succeed.
No, I love that. And this is a vague question, but I think I find it interesting speaking with operators that have all of it under their own umbrella. There's different answers. And I think it might be dependent on your market as it relates to, you know, managing 300 units in Boston, right? Where average rents are $3,000 a month is totally different than managing 300 units in Topeka, Kansas, where average rents are $700, you know, whatever it is, right? And there's, those are two entirely different businesses with different economics. But, you know, for you, when did you find that it started to get easier as it relates to having management in-house? Whether it was you made a key hire or whether it was kind of like a unit count, like, was there a point along the way where you were like, I am not spending a ton of my time on management anymore? We have some level of infrastructure here to where this is starting to become an actual line of business that's not requiring so much of my in-person time. And I'm spending a little bit more time on the deal side, the capital side, going on podcasts, fun stuff like that. Do you kind of have a delineation or a point where you found that started to actually be the case?
Yeah, for us, I mean, the structure was there, but it required us within that structure. At about 800 units, we felt like the org chart was developed enough and there was enough tiers in that org chart to remove us from the majority of the operational responsibility for say like 90% of the workload, right? We're still involved in our business. And when those 10% challenges come up that need a unique problem solving ability, we were in there. But at 800 units, what we were able to do is have the revenue to support an org chart where there's a leasing agent, there's a maintenance tech, there's a maintenance supervisor, there's a property manager, and they're reporting to a regional manager, right? And so regional manager comes with a level of experience and a payroll expense that is hard to service when you don't have as many units. So you're right, you know, it depends on how much your rents are and all that thing. For us, that came at about 800 units when we felt like, wow, this is allowing us to take a step away from the quote unquote day to day.
Yeah. I mean, I think it's an important topic because I think, and again, as we just, you know, we've mentioned a couple times here, like different markets, you can get away with different management or the infrastructure of your management company is going to be different depending on the average rents in your marketplace, right? And what you're managing as well. 800 units of Class A requires a totally different team and time investment than 800 units of Class C, right? Those are different ball games. But I think it's important to mention because of the fact that while there are a lot of benefits to having everything in-house and under one umbrella, or under your umbrella, I should say, there is a sacrifice in that it does pull you away from what most people in the, you know, on podcasts or that talk about real estate, when they talk about growing a large portfolio, everybody defines the highest value activities as finding deals and raising money, right? And building awareness around your business from a deals and dough standpoint versus the operational side. And, but the operational side is obviously critical, as we both know. And I think that it can be tough along the way if you're bootstrapping the management infrastructure along with kind of slowly growing the portfolio to allocate your time effectively, but that's helpful from a framing standpoint for people that are making these decisions along the way. So today, I guess, just in general, on a regular basis, you mentioned, you know, the portfolio is at 1,300 doors now, obviously very sizable. What does your day-to-day look like from a time standpoint? Like, are you pretty removed outside of a couple of weekly meetings overseeing that line of business, and it's your brother, a COO, that kind of really owns that? Or what does your time investment look like now, or time allocation, I should say?
Yeah, I gave the titles of, you know, CEO, COO, CFO. I think a better way to describe that is I push the company forward. that creates challenges. And my brother cleans that up through systems and processes and building the team. And then Coleman, our partner, our CFO, keeps track of all of it. So
yeah,
accounting, backend data, analytics, all that stuff, which there is overlap between all of us, right? We're not working in silos, but that's how we kind of define those roles. What we've done really well is while we're at 1300 units, we have been intentional to build the company in a way that we won't be overwhelmed. Our systems and processes won't be overwhelmed when we get to 3000 or 6000. And one way we're doing that is we have always invested heavily on using data and analytics to help us make decisions and monitor the performance of our on-site operations. So we spend a lot of time with that. So my day-to-day would be like reviewing those reports, right? So yes, I have a background in as a maintenance tech, but I'm not looking at each work order to say, you know, did this toilet get fixed correctly? But I can quickly run reports that say, what is our average length of time that our work orders are open? I can run that report on each individual tech. I can see how we service resident requested work orders relative to just internal work orders for something in a common area. And so we have all these metrics where I'm reviewing those to ensure the vision that I've cast for the company is holding up, right? Based on the actions that the individuals at the on-site level take. And so one of my favorite quotes or that I tell our team all the time, or even I tell our investors, I think a lot of people know, and you talk about what gets talked about on podcasts or at conferences. A lot of people think about investment returns when they, or dollars, right? When they go to multifamily or commercial real estate. But what a lot of people miss is investment returns are supported by on-site operations, and on-site operations are supported by the people who work there. And so it's all about building the team that is supporting all of those, because without it, if you don't have the market conditions pushing you, it's going to get pretty messy on the back end if you don't have the support systems to produce the financial returns.
100%. No, I, and that's a great way to frame it, right? We get so caught up talking about projections and returns and investment thesis. And it's like all that stuff, you know, all the stuff that's very high level, right? Mm-hmm. But fundamentally, there needs to be a real focus on execution, whether that's on the construction side or whether it's on the management side. Mm-hmm. And, you know, through these mediums, right, they obviously don't get talked about as much because maybe it doesn't get as many clicks. I like to listen to it, right? I think a lot of active folks really enjoy these types of conversations. Mm-hmm. But, you know, it's different than investing in public equities, right? Where that's not necessarily, I mean, obviously it's a component of it, right? You want to invest in companies that are being run well, but it's not nearly as significant of a component of the conversation as it needs to be as it relates to multifamily, right? Where there's all kinds of execution risk associated with different types of deals, and that needs to be investigated and managed along the way. So that's a great way to frame it and think about it. Now, you know, you've mentioned that obviously one of the core competencies of you and the business in general is operating well, right? So a couple quick questions on operations. As it relates to ensuring that you guys are doing a good job and tracking and confirming that you're doing a good job, I'll ask this in a vague way because I kind of want you to run with it any which way you see fit, but are there KPIs that you're returning to? And I'm talking kind of tactical property management, right?
Okay.
We buy an asset. We want to track how well we're doing. KPIs from a management standpoint, construction standpoint that you really want to focus on. Are there systems and processes that in your mind are like, if we get these right, then the rest of the stuff is probably going to fall into place. And that's kind of our 80-20, right? If we knock this 80% out of the park, the other 20% is going to fall in line. Mm-hmm. Like, what do you think about from an operational standpoint as it relates to assessing how you guys are doing internally, mm-hmm. as it relates to actually executing on the management side?
Yeah, there's a lot there, and I have a lot to say on it, but I think we could use maybe two entry-level positions because it will be relatable to a lot of your listeners. So like maintenance tech, leasing agent, right? Most people who have even a couple hundred units are going to have those positions within their property management company. So we can talk about what KPIs we look at for those positions, how we hold them accountable. But you talked about, before we get to that, you talked about 80-20. Like, why do we care about these KPIs? When I do budget comparative reports, so I'm looking at our actuals and our budget, the one account that has the biggest trickle down impact, and everyone knows this but I don't think aligns their KPIs with this. It's vacancy, right? Like,
yeah.
Vacancy is your trick, is your 80-20 account when you look at your income statement. Like, if you get vacancy right, you're in a much better position to succeed on in your budget report. So how do we align our KPIs for a maintenance tech? So maintenance tech, we hold them accountable to number of work orders completed per day. We hold them accountable to the speed at which they complete all work orders. And then we even have a subcategory of the speed at which they complete resident requested work orders. We look at this data on a monthly basis. We feed the data to them on a weekly basis so they can monitor and understand where they're at. But we have expectations where we say we expect 4 to 7 work orders per day from each tech. We expect resident requested work orders to be completed in no more than, on average, 48 hours. So we're monitoring all of this data as it comes in through our property management software. And then we're pushing out reports to both the maintenance tech and the maintenance supervisor to say, here's where you're at, right? You know, you're completing on average 8 a day. Fantastic job. And why this is so important, actually, is like, you probably know this. Some of your listeners probably know this. I certainly know it as a previous maintenance tech, but our industry, the property management industry, if you ask our industry as a whole, you say, how do you know if you have a good maintenance tech? The answer is like, if they have no backlog, they're good. But if they have a backlog in work orders, they're bad. Like, they're not keeping up. And that's so unsophisticated and like lacks any kind of analytical look at what they're doing, because as you know, you could have one guy down the street that's sleeping in the maintenance shop, you know, hiding in the corner, sleeping in the maintenance shop, and he's closing out work orders or he's band-aiding every repair. And so the property's falling apart. Residents are ticked off. So they're moving out. So your vacancy's climbing. Then you got the other guy who fixes everything to a really high standard. Residents are comfortable with him coming into their apartment. So they submit more maintenance requests. So he has a backlog, but he's doing a very good job. This guy's got it getting written up while the other guy's sleeping behind the fridge. Why I care so much about KPI is because it allows us to acknowledge top performers. And if you can acknowledge top performers, you can attract top performers. So when you acknowledge them, I mean acknowledge them through praise, but also compensation, right? So our best techs will be paid more because they have more productivity, because I can tell that through a number. And so that's a KPI for maintenance. I'll pause and see if you want me to go into leasings.
Real quick, because I do want to get into leasing, but and you might touch on this as you start talking about how you track success on the leasing side. How do you gather this data? Is this through property management software? Is this more of a manual process that's applied behind the scenes in terms of you're collecting it from different sources? You know, we don't have to maybe spend too much time because it's kind of a very tactical specific question, but just in general, what does that process look like from a data collection standpoint?
So we use a property management software called AppFolio. A lot of people are familiar with it. It does not have the level of sophistication that we would want for the data analytics and metrics that we're tracking. So a lot of times over the years, we have left the software and gone into different things, whether it's Excel, Google Sheets, these types of things. Ultimately, that's evolved into having people who are a lot smarter than me in tech to write scripts to be able to scrape the data, automatically put it into the right places, and then produce these reports that go out automatically, right? So there's been a lot of evolutions of that process. And some of it was manual for a long time until it got to the point where it's like, look, we're pumping out 10,000 work orders here. We need a little more sophistication on how we're handling this data on the back end. And what we did was we hired some people to build that for us, to write scripts to be able to then process.
Yeah. I mean, AppFolio, right? It's going to get you some level of insight into the, you know, a few key data points. But if you're talking the level of insight you're describing, yeah, you may have to start diving a little bit deeper into the process. So that was just, you know, share the listeners' context as to how this, where it's coming from, and the work you're putting in to acquire that data, which I think is important to highlight. But let's talk about leasing. You know, feel free to run on that in whichever way you'd like to.
Yeah, I think one thing I'll mention with leasing is we are very intentional about aligning commissions and compensation with our own financial benefit, right? So like the industry standard is you sign a lease, you get a flat rate, let's call it $100. Or you renew a lease and you get a flat rate, $25. You know, it's different in every market, but that is norm structure. What we've done is we say, we do it a little bit differently. And again, vacancy is the 80-20 of the account that we're trying to impact. But we know that vacancy, most property management companies will hold their leasing team accountable for vacancy. But vacancy is broken down in our company into three components. It's from the time the resident moves out until the construction starts, then the time the construction starts to the time the construction finishes, and then the third phase, which is when the unit is ready to be leased and when the leasing agent fills that with a new resident. So obviously vacancy is from the first part to the second part, but the first part is our project managers are responsible for that because they're coordinating the dates of how quickly our construction team can get it. Then what we call our turnover teams are responsible for the speed of that middle section of vacancy. Final section is leasing. So what we say is our leasing commission is based off how quickly a leasing professional can fill that unit within the date that it's available. And so we know the daily rent. That's not complicated, right? You take a $1,000 rental and you divide it by 30, you know the daily rent. So we tell our leasing professionals, we expect you to fill the unit within 7 days, but anything 7 days or less, you get a third of the daily rent. And so like they're very good about lining up that date, right? When the unit is available to rent, the next day the person is moving in. And our team over all of 2023 averaged 2.5 days, right? So like they're very good at reverse engineering and selling that unit, saying this is when it's available. We need you to move in this date. But then we can hold those other team members responsible for their components of vacancy as well and not hold the leasing professionals accountable for how long it's taking the unit to be turned over from a construction standpoint. But Axel, real quick, I think what's so important is the reason we have 1,300 units as of yesterday, we are 99% occupied. It's hard to do. It's significantly above industry standard. But why we do that is because each of those components are all in-house and they all trust each other. So if you think of a workflow, the resident who currently lives at a unit puts a 30-day notice in, right? So they, at that 30-day trigger, the project manager plugs into our project management calendar. Here's when the construction is going to start. We average about 3.5 days to renovate the unit. And so they know here's the date when it's going to be done. Everybody trusts each other. And so what happens is that leasing professional starts to lease 45 days before that is even ever empty, right? So like that's how they line that date up. That's how we keep that so tight. But as you know, if you go out to vendors and you have different people painting, different people doing carpet, different people doing cleaning, they can't trust that date. And so they don't lease until they know it's done.
Yeah. Yeah. And I mean, that's the challenge too, is, you know, I think it's one thing to bring management in-house, right? Where you have, you know, you got a, I don't know, 300-400 units, you got a PM, you got a couple of maintenance techs, you got a leasing agent, you know, maybe a maintenance coordinator of some kind, office manager, whatever your team looks like, right? Plus, minus, couple less, however you structure it. It's a whole nother thing to have construction in-house, right? I think that is a much more challenging business line to oversee and to bring in-house for the average multifamily investor, right? You get somebody who grows a portfolio, they find great deals, they raise money. They know that there's value in having all of this in-house. And they've been on asset management calls probably with their PM on a weekly basis, what have you. Like they have an understanding of the tactical front lines management process, right? There's some level of understanding there. They can replicate their third-party management business, bring it in-house. But construction's like a little bit more of a amorphous kind of process, I think, for an individual that doesn't come from that world. And obviously you came from that world just because it was such a formative part of the early part of your investing career. But somebody that doesn't necessarily come from that world, I think it's a little bit easier to understand the management side and to feel comfortable with owning that versus construction. And I think that's a much more challenging part of the process, at least maybe in my opinion, right? And as I look at my own experience, do you have, this is probably a hard question to answer, but do you have any recommendations for maybe somebody who has management house, but they're still hiring GCs, they're still subbing out the flooring and the paint and all of this stuff to try to gain some control over that in terms of couple of hires maybe you make to start trying to bring construction in-house. Maybe you try to build a crew, maybe you try to find a project manager that can a little bit more diligently manage the P&L and the team there. Like, how would you think about that if you didn't have that under your umbrella, but you were going to want to bring it in?
Yeah, I'm hesitant to say like people should, right? You should know your core competency. You should know what you're good at. And there are people who are like, you know, have a very different business than mine, but are extremely, extremely successful. Like, you have some people who are just masters at like sales and marketing, raising capital. And they do a fantastic job of building out that investor base so that way they don't have to pay as high of yield. Well, I'm not. Like, I'm a blue collar guy that just knows construction. So I don't do a lot of sales and marketing and other things. And so I have to give up efficiency on some other things, right? Like, my pref might have to be higher, or my splits might have to be more favorable. And the guy who's an expert sales and marketing and building an investor pool might be like, that's crazy, right? And I'm like, you're crazy for paying $25,000 per unit when we turn ours for 15, right? We all just have to know what we're really strong at. But you're right. You know, I've spent years learning how to run an efficient construction process. If I was going to give a tip to be of help to you and your listeners, you know, what I've learned is keep your tradesmen, build processes that keep your tradesmen from having to leave the apartment when they're renovating, right? So easier said than done, but tradesmen prefer to not have to run and get materials. They prefer everything to be there available for them because what they're good at, what their core competency is renovating that apartment. So build a system that allows them to do that. And for us, you know, with the project managers, pallets show up on day one on the front door full of materials. They unpack it. They receive the order. Everything for that floor plan is there. And so they don't have to leave and go to Home Depot. They're not running materials. I mean, actually, to tell you how much we've honed this in, you know, my brother went on site and he's monitoring how his system is working. And he's looking, he's in the apartment, he's looking around, and we run our turnovers in teams of four guys. And he's looking at the kitchen counter, and he's like, there's Red Bull cans on the counter and Gatorade and all that from our, you know, our tradesmen. And he's like, where do you guys get those from? And he's like, oh, we run up to, you know, the gas station at the corner and we usually buy those. So my brother's like, well, change the process. Every new pallet that shows up with materials from Home Depot is going to have a pack of Gatorade and a box of Red Bull, because the cost of those drinks is so little compared to the inefficiency of them running up there, getting stuck in traffic. Oh, the guy who left has the tool that I need in his van. And so my advice would be, if you can find a project manager or find a GC who understands that the tradesmen do their best work when they're there at the property. And so building processes and having people who understand that, you pick up a lot of efficiency from keeping people working.
I love that, right? Because specifically what you, I mean, obviously that was a great tactical tip for folks that are overseeing a job site, right? But I think what you just described as know your core competency and understand that you're going to make some trades here to, you know, you can't have it all. It's difficult to truly have it all, right? Mm-hmm. As it relates to the cheapest construction costs, right? You have all of that in-house, you have management in-house, and you're doing an excellent job at that, and you find the best deals and you raise the capital with the lowest return expect. It's hard to do all of those different things. Mm-hmm. I mean, if you are, you know, then you're really the A+ tier one investor, but mm-hmm. you have to spend your time more in some areas than others, you know. And it's funny, in our business, just as the listeners are maybe aware of this, and it's like almost a reminder, we do a lot of direct to seller, a lot of getting in front of owners. And we typically put stuff under contract at really compelling pricing that folks that are relying on brokers aren't, you know, they're not securing that. And then I spend a decent amount of time on the capital side to raise capital to reasonable return expectations. We do a good job on the management side, but the construction side, we're probably paying true market because we're hiring GCs. And we're, as you mentioned, we might be paying the $20,000 for the $15,000 unit turn. But that's, but it's okay because we go all in and we're buying something at $5,000 less per door on the buy side, right? Because that's where we're spending our time. So it's hard to have it all. And I think that's a great tip, is maybe you don't need to do that. You just get better at the one thing that you're already pretty good at and that you already enjoy doing. So I think that's great. Real quick about initial takeover process, because I think this will probably be really interesting for folks as it relates to implementing a business plan on a multifamily asset. Get a deal, you close it, right? What is the first 30, 60, 90 days typically look like for you guys in terms of where you're focusing your time, standard, you know, standard renovations, interiors, common areas, exterior, stuff like that? How do you think about the order in which you do different things? And I guess what you're working on in general as well in that first, you know, couple of months?
Yeah, I think I can give you some general rules, but it really does depend, right? So we've bought, you know, we bought a 246 unit foreclosure with 100 vacancies and no one had been, you know, managing it for a year and a half. So like the approach on that takeover is going to be very different than, you know, we bought 150 unit off of what is a reputable management company that had just outgrown the asset and didn't want to go through the renovation process after owning it for 15 years. And so the resident base is very different and the approach is very different. But a general rule I would say is when we get ready to approach the variables that come with a takeover, we get everyone in the room on our team together, right? So the people who are navigating those different variables need to understand the unified approach that we're going in at, because they might say, well, last time we did this. And I was like, well, last time it was a foreclosure. This is very different. And so we just try to make really, we try to create a lot of clarity within our internal team. And then from there, we try to create a lot of clarity to the residents, right? So we'll send out welcome letters that say, here is the plan. Here's what we're intending to do. And through both of those channels, we try to be honest, right? And so there's times where you have to answer questions in ways that people don't want to hear the answer that you're going to give, like, is my rent going to go up? And you might have to answer that as like, you know, our intention is to improve the community. And as such, we may have to raise rents. But anyway, I'm getting too far down the rabbit hole. The point is like each individual takeover can have nuance to it, but you better make sure everyone who's involved in that understands the unified narrative.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, you have to get on the same page with everybody that's going to be executing, because as we all know, right, that or everyone who's in this game knows, when you close, it's off to the races, right? I mean, if you want to show those juicy IRRs on your previous deals to the new investors, it's a function of time. It's a function of how quickly you're going from close to stabilized or to that capital event, what have you, which means everybody needs to be rowing in the same direction and be aligned in terms of the order in which things are happening, how it's happening, and how we're communicating with the folks that are living at the property. And, you know, I think it's interesting to think about this, and I'll just share kind of some changes in our business. And I want to ask you maybe if you've seen a similar thing in yours. And this will be a bit of a current events topic to kind of round out the show, which I think everybody appreciates nowadays as the market's a little bit more challenging to understand, I guess is the way to put it. I think most folks buying multifamily from 2018 to 2022, obviously you could be a little bit more of a lazy operator or asset manager and the market was going to help you out. We all know that. I think that's been talked about ad nauseum, but there was also components of that process where I think there may have been a different incentive from an asset management standpoint, an operational standpoint, where, for example, if you bought a property in 2019, by 2021, regardless of what market you're in, your rents probably increased another 15, 20% over that time period. Maybe you have a tenant that was there for a couple of years and you don't mind if they leave and you have some vacancy and you're spending money on turnover because you're hitting such a nice new rent. And that's going to help you on your appraisal when you go to refi or sell or what have you, right? So I don't think that there was a lot of focus on like renewals, for example, during that time period, right? People were okay with folks not renewing because they were okay getting a new tenant in there at that true market rent. Whereas now I think that that's a different thought process for most folks throughout the country. I think, you know, the Midwest hasn't had the type of, you know, the rents haven't been hit as hard as those high supply markets like the Phoenixes or the Austins or the Tampas or what have you. But they haven't grown at the same rate either as they did during that time period. And renewals and retaining tenants and increasing their length of stay, I think, has become much more of a focus for a lot of operators throughout the country. I think that's a fair assessment to make. But in general, you know, that's just one change in the asset management process. One, would be interested in your take on that. But two, has the asset management process, the operational process on stuff you already own changed over the last couple of years? Since, you know, let's call it when rates started to go up in late 22 to maybe or mid 2022 to now over the last 18, 24 months, has there been changes in how you approach that part of the game versus maybe the few years prior? And if so, would love to hear it because I think a lot of people are trying to figure that out right now.
Yeah, I would say of course, right? We always are ebbing and flowing with the market, but I would think that my answer would be a lot more mild than most of the people who would answer that question. The reason being is all of our investments have always been 10-year holds is how we project them. So we're a longer term buy and hold. And so over a longer time frame, things even out a little bit more. But I'd love to answer your question in another way. I think it was in like 2023, I had an investor ask me, he said, what are you guys doing to prepare for the coming economic recession? And my answer was like, I have been preparing for this for 15 years. Like I have been building operational foundations that are just rock solid. And over my 1300 units, I have all long-term fixed rate debt on everything. And so I don't think I was blind to the fact of renewals are important. Like I didn't ever lost sight of that because our business plan was a little bit longer term. And so we weren't, you know, flipping these apartment buildings and just trying to juice them up and dump them out. We were always going to be the beneficiary of reinvesting into resident base and operations and all those things. So we really took our time to get that right. You know, vacancy, we talked about vacancy before and how impactful it can be to the bottom line. You know, we've always said we will work extremely hard to deliver the feeling of home to our residents so we can retain them. But if and when they move out, we're going to be one of the best at handling the turnover. So there's those two components of vacancy, right? Avoid it. But if you can't, how do you handle it? And so I know that our average length of stay over 1300 units is 5 years. We own C to B class apartments. It's significantly above industry standards, which means 80% of our renewals every year get accepted. It's really a really number I'm super proud of because it's not easy to do at the size we're at. And so I think what your question was, like, how have we pivoted? Not that much, right? Not that much.
Yeah. But that context is helpful, though, because it's important to understand what your objective is when you are asset managing a building, right? If you're planning for 10-year holds and you have the debt that aligns with that structure and your investors are primed to expect a hold period like that, well, you're not necessarily going to be short-term focused as it relates to maximizing a rent roll, maybe at the expense of NOI, but which is, I think, a mode that a lot of investors were in for a long period of time is, yeah, maybe it doesn't make as much long-term sense to you know, really actively push the renewal price on our existing residents to the point to where they might want to leave, but that's okay. We'll get a new tenant in at 1700 when the market rent might be 1650, but it serves our objective of really showing a nice juicy rent roll to the bank or the buyer when we go and sell it. That's a totally different ballgame than I'm in year two of my hold period here. That's just simply not something that makes any sense for us to do, given we're going to own this for another 8 years, right? Yeah. And it makes sense to renew and actually minimize expenses, minimize vacancy, push more to the bottom line. Yeah. So I think that's helpful context because people look for a black and white answer to a lot of that stuff, I think, oftentimes when it's just not a black and white question at the end of the day.
Yeah, I think what they call the jargon in our industry for that is called pump and dump, right? You pump that NOI up and then you sell it off to someone else. But you got residents in here that have credit scores of 400, no security deposits. They're paying a high rent, but it's a hot potato game. And we were just never in that game.
Yeah. And that's, you know, again, at some point you got to eat what you buy, right? Which is operate, you know, another way to say eat what you kill or operate what you buy, I guess, a phrase that a partner of mine uses, and I'm botching it because he says it much better than me. But he's like, oftentimes people are buying a deal where they understand the entire objective is to trade in and out of it. And they know that they can bring those rents to a number and sell it to the you know, call it the greater fool who maybe isn't as discerning around who the residents are, what, you know, what their credit scores are, as you mentioned, or what the story is behind that. And it was more of a lipstick renovation to get somebody in at a high rent on that first lease, and then we're going to go sell it to the next guy. But at some point, if you don't sell it to the next guy, you have to operate it and you have to live with the bed that you've made. And if you're, you know, if 10-year projections are totally different than I think a lot of people in this business who are setting 3 to 5 year expectations with their investors, right? Those are two totally different businesses to run. Mm-hmm. Now I want to round out the show just so you can share your criteria, which is funny because we should have obviously people know you're buying in Cincinnati by this point, but within Cincinnati, you mentioned B and C class, like types of deals, unit ranges. Sounds like you're doing everything from light value add to, you know, pretty hefty repositions when you describe that foreclosure deal. Give everybody a sense of what you're actually buying in case somebody out there comes across something that fits your criteria.
Yeah, thank you. I think, like, if I had to describe my perfect deal, it would be in, you know, the northern suburbs of Cincinnati, built in the mid 90s, and it would be 200 units, 100 one bedrooms and 100 two bedrooms. And it would be quite cookie cutter for me to go in and rip through renovations and improve the efficiencies on the expense side. You know, that's the perfect story, but I've yet to have that come across my desk. Where we've had success in, say, the last 5 years is kind of above the mom and pop buyer, below the institutional buyer. And what that looks like for us in our market is 70 to 150 unit apartment communities. And there's enough inefficiencies within those assets that, you know, we just talked about it all show, but the wind has been at our back for 15 years. Anyone who owns a 250 unit, I shouldn't say anyone, most people who own a 250 unit community have figured out how to maximize that value with the wind at their back. And so where we have found that upside, where we have found that potential and therefore the returns, is that 70 to 150 unit range.
Love that. No, that's great. Well, Jared, this has been an incredible show. I think a lot of folks are going to walk away with something really tangible here to implement in their business if they're on the active side. And I think for the LPs listening, you couldn't have done a better job showcasing why you guys are better than the competition relative to that market. And then just, you know, in general, right? I think, you know, the number that sticks out to me is an 80% renewal rate is like a ridiculous figure for CMB class multifamily. We're not at that number. We would love to be at that number. We're always working to increase that number, but that's an unbelievable stat. And clearly you've built a hell of a business. If folks want to reach out and learn a little bit more about what you got going on outside of what we just talked about on the show or want to contact you, where can they do so?
Through our website would probably be best. So our website is SNS Capital Group. That's three letters at the start, like Sam, Nancy, Sam, capitalgroup.com. There's a contact us tab, and I believe those emails come to me.
Perfect. All right, man. Thanks again for your time. This was great.
Yeah, no, Axel, thank you. And again, I appreciate anybody on the back end who works on the show.